blind as a child. I danced like it was 1999. My dreams were wild. The promise of this new world would be mine.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Tim DeChristopher Lecture, Wielding the Power of Vulnerability, Thursday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Tim DeChristopher, as Bitter 70, disrupted a Bureau of Land Management oil and gas auction in 2008 by outbidding oil companies for land parcels around Arches and Canyonlands National Parks in Utah. His actions led to a 21-month imprisonment. Again, that's a lecture by Tim DeChristopher titled Wielding the Power of Vulnerability, Thursday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and it is now just 9 o'clock on April 6th, this Wednesday. Coming up this morning on The Boo at 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints reports on Mexican environmentalist Gustavo Castro, who was wounded after the murder of Honduran indigenous leader Berta Cáceres. He is free and back in Mexico, and we hear from the author also of Unsettled, Cambodian Refugees in the New York City Hyperghetto. And at 11, it's the KBOO Bike Show, bringing you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And now, next up, political perspectives, host Per Fogarin speaks with Adam Hochschild about his new book, Spain in Our Hearts, Americans in the Spanish Civil War, 1936 to 1939, A Sweeping History.
From the farms, from the cities, from every land came the Abe Lincoln Brigade. With a dream in their hearts and a gun in their hands, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. No passerán, no passerán, so sang the Abe Lincoln Brigade. Across the years and the oceans we still sing the song of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fogarin. This is Political Perspectives. This is the name of the show, and my guest is Adam Hochschild, who has written a wonderful book called Spain in Our Hearts, all about the Americans who fought in the Spanish Civil War back in the 30s. Adam, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Per. It's good to be here.
Well, you're going to be at Powell's tonight, is that right?
That's right. It's 7:30 this evening.
And I would advise people to get there early because it's not a huge room and it fills up pretty fast when you have an interesting speaker. So get there early. I always do.
Good.
And so let's talk about the background. In 1936, kind of that was a very bad year, but there was one bright spot, leftist... So a Social Democratic Party was elected in Spain.
That's right. Spain was a very young democracy then. Only in 1931 had they brought an end to centuries of monarchy that had been mixed with a period of military dictatorship in the 1920s. And then in early 1936, progressives all over the world felt cheered because a coalition of liberal and left-wing parties called the Popular Front won the elections, February of that year, and it seemed like all of the things that Spain needed, land reform, secularization of education, taking it out of the hands of a very reactionary Catholic Church, reducing some of the vast inequalities of wealth in that country, could move forward. But then several months later, July of 1936, a small group of extremely right-wing generals rose up in military revolt against the elected government of the Spanish Republic, and the Spanish Civil War was on.
What was it like? I thought it was very striking. In one of the early chapters, you talk about sort of the social revolution in Barcelona.
Well, one of the fascinating things about the Spanish Civil War, an extraordinary, dramatic, tragic piece of history, and one of the aspects of it that doesn't get written about much is this. When these generals, from whom Francisco Franco quickly emerged as leader, when they staged their coup attempt to take over the country, they initially seized about a third of Spain. In much of the areas of the country where they were turned back, they were defeated not by the Spanish Republic's army, most of which had gone over to these rebel generals, but by militias organized very hastily, badly armed, by left-wing political parties and trade unions, often including armed women. And these militias rather suddenly then found themselves in control of large swaths of the country, particularly Barcelona, this is the second largest city, and surrounding Catalonia. And they carried out one of the most far-reaching social revolutions ever seen anywhere on Earth, certainly the most far-reaching one ever seen in Western Europe. Workers took over factories. Landless peasants took over these huge estates they had once worked as laborers. Waiters took over restaurants. The dining room of the Hotel Ritz in Barcelona was turned into People's Cafeteria Number 1 for the poor. Locomotive engineers took over the railway system. Trolley car drivers took over the urban transport. Europe had never seen anything like this. What fascinates me is that the foreign correspondents who flocked to Spain to cover the Civil War, and there were hundreds of them, largely ignored this in their reporting. For every 500 stories about the battle for Madrid, you're lucky if you can find one about this social revolution in the Northeast.
Well, kind of an amazing time, just the way you described it.
Well, you know, this book, Spain in Our Hearts, is about Americans going through this experience. Mm-hmm. And to describe this social revolution in the Northeast, because the foreign correspondents ignored it, I want to see it through American eyes. And the most extensive record of this left by an American eyewitness are a series of letters and an unpublished memoir written by a 19-year-old American woman.
Yes, I was going to get to her. Tell us, Lois Orr was her name.
Yeah, Lois Orr was 19 years old. She was from Louisville, Kentucky. She was a student at the University of Louisville. And earlier in 1936, she had married an economics instructor at the university, Charles Orr. And they'd gone to Europe in the summer for their honeymoon. They were very political people. Leftists, but with a very independent anti-Stalinist streak. They were traveling in France and Germany when they began to hear news of this coup attempt in Spain and of this social revolution in the Northeast. And it excited them because here there seemed to be a revolution that was genuinely being made from the bottom up and not something imposed from the top down as it happened in the Soviet Union. And Lois, who was the live wire of this couple, said to her somewhat older, somewhat stodgier husband, we have to go there. And they hitchhiked to Barcelona, arrived 2 months after the coup in the midst of this enormous social upheaval, lived and worked there for the next 10 months. And there were young idealists who came to Barcelona at that time from all over the world. For example, in the same circles that they moved in, there was a 23-year-old political refugee from Germany named Willy Brandt, who 3 decades later became Chancellor of West Germany. One day, after they'd been there a couple of months, a very tall, gangly Englishman with a pronounced stammer showed up, said his name was Blair and he wanted to volunteer to fight for the revolution, mentioned a couple of books he'd written under another name, which the Orrs had never heard of, and he went off to the front. And Eric Blair was, of course, George Orwell. And in his great, great memoir of that period, Homage to Catalonia, he does talk about this social revolution.
So these generals now, they were all based in Africa for sort of, supposedly to get them out of the way, but it gave them a kind of a, I guess, a safe place to plot this rebellion.
It did. The only wars that Spain had fought in the several decades before 1936 were colonial wars against rebels in their African colonies, primarily in what was then called Spanish Morocco. And these were very, very brutal wars, as colonial wars tend to be. Then when the left liberal coalition came to power in early 1936, they were worried about all these right-wing generals and decided to get them out of the way by dispatching them off to posts in the colonies or remote outposts of Spain. General Franco, for example, was sent to the Canary Islands to the Spanish military garrison there. But of course, this turned out to be a disastrous mistake because it allowed the generals to plot their coup attempt in secret, which they did very effectively. Messages hand-carried by couriers so that telephones couldn't be tapped or anything like that. And then July 17th, 1936, there was spontaneous attempt to seize power by them and their followers all over Spain.
And they were known as the Africanistas.
That's right, because they had been in these African colonial wars. General Franco said at one point, without Africa, I can scarcely explain myself.
And was it a majority of the troops were Moors?
Well, the heart of the Spanish army was called the Army of Africa, and part of that were Moors or Moroccan mercenaries, Arab and Berber soldiers who joined the army really as a way of trying to not let their families starve. It was a period of drought, great poverty, middle of the Great Depression. So there were all these Moroccan mercenaries, or Moors as they were known. There was also something called the Spanish Foreign Legion, which despite its name was mainly Spaniards, a large number of them ex-convicts who had been allowed to leave prison before their terms ended if they enlisted in the army. So pretty tough bunch. This was the core of the Nationalist Army, the Spanish Nationalists. Mm-hmm. These are what the right-wing generals called themselves.
Now, they were told that they sort of had the idea that they were fighting for, were they fighting for Islam in some way or other?
Well, these Moors, the Moroccan mercenaries, were themselves Muslims, but they were actually fighting for an army, one of whose purposes was to restore power to Spain's extremely reactionary Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And their officers told them, you know, they were fighting against godless socialists and godless communists and so on.
You know, that almost seems like a forerunner to our little endeavor in Afghanistan.
Well,
you know, fighting the Soviet-backed regime in Afghanistan. This is Zbigniew Brzezinski's brilliant idea, you know, getting these mujahideen. I don't know. It's like, it seemed like a pattern going on here.
Well, it certainly fatally weakened the Soviets, and then, of course, we got dragged into Afghanistan as well and are still there.
Well, yes. Tell us about one, sort of, I guess, in a way, one of the central figures in your book is Bob Merriman.
That's right. I like to do history. I like to try to bring a period of time alive by focusing on 10 or 12 characters who lived through a period of time. Ideally, people whose lives intersected in some way or other. One pair of them were Lois and Charles Orr, whom we were just talking about. Bob Merriman and his wife Marion are another couple in this book. And they had gotten married on the day in 1932 when they both graduated from the University of Nevada at Reno. Then Bob became a graduate student in economics at Berkeley, and I was startled in going through his papers to discover that they lived during their 2.5 years in Berkeley a couple of blocks from where I do today. And every time I walk from my house to the Graduate School of Journalism on the Berkeley campus where I teach a class, I walk past where this couple lived. They lived there. Then they went to Russia for a couple of years where he was doing research for his PhD thesis. Then they went to Spain. Then he went to Spain to volunteer to fight. He was one of the first Americans who arrived to volunteer to fight for the Republic. And rather by accident, he became one of the highest ranking Americans. When he'd been a student working his way through the University of Nevada during the Depression, he had discovered that you could earn an extra $8.50 a month by taking ROTC. And that was a good deal of money in those days. So he did so, which meant that when he arrived in Spain, he was one of the very few Americans who'd had any kind of military training. And almost immediately, he was made commander of the American battalion. Then when he took that into combat, really for the first time, he was wounded, sent a telegram to his wife, Marion. She came to Spain to nurse him. And when she saw that he was determined to go back into action after he recovered, she decided to stay in Spain, volunteered herself, and became the only American woman in uniform at the International Brigade's headquarters. They stayed together in Spain for about a year. Then she came back to the United States. He stayed on and became eventually chief of staff of the 15th International Brigade, which was the unit that included American, British, and Canadian volunteers, and some from other countries as well. In April 1938, he went missing in action, and his body was never found. This was true of a number of the Americans who were lost in the war, you know, in the chaos of a retreat or a major battle. No one knew what had become of them. And it was, of course, very hard on his widow, Marion. She never knew exactly how he died. 49 years after his death, she got a letter from a man in Spain saying, "I've had to keep my head down during all the years of the dictatorship, but now I can speak at last, and I can tell you, I fought beside your husband, I admired him greatly, and I was with him when he died, and here's where it was." She was then 79 years old. And it was a great relief to her to hear this. You know, a half century later, anybody's memory is a little shaky, and there are other people who say, no, it wasn't at that spot, it was this spot. But it was a very moving story, and it brought her great peace to have this word. And when I went to Spain when researching my book, I went to the hilltop where he was last seen alive, just to see what that looked like.
Well, apparently everybody admired Bob Merriman.
Yeah, he was everybody who met this man, you know, other American volunteers, the correspondents, Ernest Hemingway used him as something of a model for the figure of Robert Jordan in Hemingway's novel For Whom the Bell Tolls, who, like Merriman, is a tall, athletic, courageous former university instructor from the American West who loses his life in Spain. The American military attaché in Spain admired Merriman greatly and wrote about him in reports home. Seems to have been a very charismatic man. Fascinating to me because he was an absolute true-believing communist until the moment he was killed, as was his wife. And one of the things I want to do in studying this period is to understand the appeal that communism had for people at that time, and at the same time also to portray other sorts of people, like Lois Orr, whom we were talking about a moment ago, was definitely not a communist. She believed in sort of democratic, from the bottom up.
She sounded like socialism. An anarchist. Or...
Yeah, she was much more of an anarchist. And then there were other volunteers, some of whom I wrote about, who were distinctly non-communist but volunteered to fight in Spain, willingly joining the international brigades that were organized by the world's communist parties, knowing that this was the only group of people who were organizing to send a large number of volunteers there. So, you know, I've got people sort of across the political spectrum.
Well, I think was it Hemingway you quoted as said that he kind of admired communist soldiers but not their priests or something like that?
Yes, he said this to the Daily Worker correspondent in Spain who didn't seem to understand what he was talking about. Hemingway said to him, "You communists, I admire you when you're soldiers, but not when you're priests," i.e. that preaching, telling us what to think.
So we'll get into, there was a big divide between the communists and the other anti-Stalinist left groups and the anarchists. But let's talk about the war itself now. The invaders or the rebels, they came over from Africa in southern Spain and also from Portugal. I guess Portugal was allied with them then.
That's right. These rebel generals, the extreme right-wing generals, were the main force of their army was the Army of Africa, these Moorish mercenaries and Spanish Foreign Legion. They needed to get that army from Spanish Morocco to Spain in order to complete their intention of taking over the country. Who provided the essential help that enabled them to do that? Adolf Hitler, who immediately sent a squadron of transport planes. This was history's first major military airlift, airlifting these soldiers from Africa to Europe. Portugal was under a right-wing dictatorship at the time, very friendly to Franco and his generals. 8,000 Portuguese volunteered for his army. They allowed Franco and his nationalists to use the port of Lisbon and to, you know, launch an invasion across the Portuguese border into Spain. Mussolini and Hitler rushed a steady stream of supplies to Franco, aircraft, pilots, tanks, tank drivers, artillery, military advisors of all sorts. Mussolini sent 80,000 ground troops as well. They wanted to be sure that a sympathetic dictator like Franco was installed in Spain. And for Hitler, the Spanish Civil War was a chance to try out all of the weapons he was planning to use in World War II, which he knew he was going to launch. So all of the German weapons we know from that war, the major ones, the Messerschmitt 109 fighter plane, the Stuka dive bomber, the 88mm artillery piece, all of these were first used in combat in Spain.
Tell us about the war itself, the fighting.
It was very grim because here were the nationalists who gradually took over more and more and more of Spain during the course of the war.
Now they're coming from the south and from the west.
That's right. The Republic held the Spanish Republic held more or less the eastern part of the country along the Mediterranean coast. The nationalists were extremely well armed with all this help from Hitler and Mussolini. The Republic's forces very badly armed, and you can see them in pictures as soldiers, you know, without helmets, and they've got old-fashioned artillery that doesn't even have rubber tires on in their wheels. They pleaded desperately, the Spanish Republic, with the major democracies, Britain, France, the United States, to sell them arms. And they actually had the money to buy arms because the Spanish Republic had the world's fourth largest gold reserves. Spain had prospered during World War I when it remained neutral while all the other major nations of Europe were spending themselves into debt. But all the democracies, the U.S., Britain, and France, shut the door on them, turned them away, said, "We don't want to get involved in Spain. We're not going to sell you arms." And the only major country that did sell them arms was not a democracy. It was Stalin's Soviet Union. And these arms came at quite a price because Stalin demanded in return high positions for Spanish and Soviet communists in the Republic's Army's high command and in the security forces.
Tell us some more about that.
Well, there ended up being a little war within the war because communist influence in the Spanish Republic, which had been quite minimal to begin with. There were very few communists in the elected legislature early 1936, grew by leaps and bounds when the Soviet Union became the only source of arms. And indeed, those arms were essential because without them, the Spanish Republic would have lost Madrid in the fall of 1936. The war probably would have been over a couple months after that. So those arms are what kept the Spanish Republic going. But both the Communist Party and the mainstream parties of the Spanish Republic were horrified by this social revolution we were talking about that took place in Spain's northeast, because they thought, not unreasonably, that if Spain were perceived as a revolutionary society, there wasn't a prayer of getting the U.S., Britain, and France to change their minds about selling it arms. As it turned out, there wasn't a prayer of getting arms from the Western democracies anyway. But finally, this social revolution was suppressed, and there was a sort of a little war within the war of May 1937, which Orwell writes about in Homage to Catalonia, and several hundred people lost their lives. Orwell felt at the time, and other people felt their time at the time, that if there hadn't been this terrible factional infighting, the Republic could have won the Civil War, because if people felt they'd had a revolutionary society they were fighting for, they would have fought harder. But hardly anybody thinks that today. And in fact, by the 1940s, Orwell himself had changed his mind on that point and said the real course of the war was decided in London, Paris, Berlin, and Rome. London and Paris failing to sell arms to the Republic. He should have added Washington to that list, actually. Berlin and Rome being the capitals of the country that supplied Franco with all his weaponry. And I think almost everybody today would agree that's the reason why the Spanish Republic didn't win, that the other side was getting all his help from Hitler and Mussolini.
Well, this is Per Fagering, and the show is Political Perspectives. My guest is Adam Hochschild, who is the author of Spain in Our Hearts. And he will be appearing tonight at Powell's down on Burnside at 7:30, but better get there early. Mm-hmm. And so if people have any questions or comments, the number is 503-231-8187. Well, it seems to me that was a real kind of failure on the part of the democracies. I mean, he was a legal, elected government being overthrown by everybody's concerned about the rise of Hitler and Mussolini, and here was sort of another fascist overthrowing a democracy, and they just kind of sat on their hands. In fact, apparently, at least in England, there were some. Apparently, some officials had sympathies for the fascists.
Well, England was under a conservative government at that time, and there were Franco sympathizers in that government. They just didn't want to get involved. All the nations of Europe were deeply scarred and traumatized by World War I and had very little appetite for getting involved in any kind of conflict. France itself was very split over this issue. There was a liberal left coalition in power in France, but the French government felt itself to be almost on the verge of civil war at home because they sympathized with the Spanish Republic. A lot of people in the French army high command sympathized with Franco and the nationalists. France was afraid that if they sold arms to Spain, it would just cause strife at home. So they stayed out. The United States, Franklin Roosevelt was president. He was a man, of course, who understood and hated fascism, but he knew that he had no political constituency in the United States for getting deeply involved in Spain. You know, people were aware of the war here, but it was not something close to the heart of many people. Also, it's believed that Roosevelt, before the 1936 presidential election, promised the hierarchy of the American Catholic Church that he would stay neutral in Spain. The Catholic Church was very, very in favor of Franco and his nationalists because they promised to restore the power of the church in Spain. And the Spanish Republic was very anti-clerical, and mobs had killed 6,000 or 7,000 clergy in Spain. Roosevelt is believed to have made this promise to the American Catholic Church, but for various reasons, obvious reasons on both sides, it was one of these promises that was never written down, so you can't prove it. So he stayed neutral during the war. He was clearly torn. At a couple of times, he toyed with the idea of somehow or other getting U.S. arms to Spain through a third party, maybe through Latin America, but then he didn't follow through on it. And then when he saw in early 1939 that the Spanish nationalists were about to win the war, he said in a cabinet meeting, "We made a grave mistake to stay uninvolved." But by that point, it was too late.
Mm-hmm. Well, Eleanor Roosevelt is more in favor of the Republic.
She was. I mean, she had to be very diplomatic about what she said. She wrote a daily newspaper column that was widely read. But she kept alluding in that column to sufferings of the Spanish people, and she contributed money for food relief for children in Republican Spain. She also had a personal tie to what was going on there because Martha Gellhorn, the journalist who was then the lover and later became the third wife of Ernest Hemingway, was in Spain with Hemingway, writing reports for Collier's magazine here and sending a long stream of letters to Eleanor Roosevelt, who was something of a godmother for her. Martha Gellhorn had actually lived in the White House for a time before the war. The Roosevelts had the most amazing collection of long-term guests in the White House, and Gellhorn had spent some time there. Her mother was a friend of Eleanor's, and she kept writing to Eleanor Roosevelt throughout the war saying, "Please, please, you have to do something. You have to help the Spanish Republic. You have to send arms." And one thing she tried to do was this. Gellhorn and Hemingway worked on a documentary film during their time in Spain, thinking that this relatively new medium of film documentaries would be a way of reaching people that the printed word could not. And they worked on this film together. It was called The Spanish Earth. Hemingway wrote and spoke the narration. They premiered it at the White House, thanks to Gellhorn's friendship with Eleanor Roosevelt in the summer of 1937. It was the most illustrious audience you can imagine for a film premiere. It still was not enough to convince FDR to intervene, to get involved.
Well, we think of the 30s as being kind of a sort of a lefty era, but there were a lot of, real right-wingers. You know, there was a fascist movement. There's Father Coughlin. There's radio talks. The Nazi Bund marching in Yorkville in New York City. I mean, all kinds of things going on.
There were. And one of the discoveries for me in writing about this period is that even though we think of General Franco's allies as being mainly in Rome and Berlin, sending in those arms and so on, he had a very crucial ally in the Chrysler Building in New York City. That building was the headquarters of Texaco, the big oil company. And theoretically, U.S. neutrality legislation said that oil or anything else, there were many restrictions on selling it to a country at war. American goods going to a country at war couldn't travel in American ships, and the nationalists of Spain had no oil tanker. It couldn't be sold on credit, and nationalist Spain had no ready cash. Not a problem. Franco had an admirer. His name was Torquild Reber, who was the CEO of Texaco, and he was really a fascist sympathizer. breaking American law. He sold General Franco most of his oil during the war, the oil that fueled the German bombers that bombed Madrid. He shipped the oil there in American ships, Texaco's own fleet of tankers, which was violating U.S. oil. He sold Franco the oil on credit, and he gave him a huge discount, which, as far as we can tell, he never told Texaco shareholders about, and he never even told his own board of directors about it. A remarkable story that even today is relatively little known. Reber actually helped out Franco in another way as well. Texaco, being this huge multinational oil company, had all over the world in ports, had installations, tank farms, loading docks, offices, agents, and so on. Reber sent out orders to all these places, send us as quickly as you can, whenever you acquire it, information that you pick up in these ports about oil tankers heading for the Spanish Republic. That information was then collated and passed on to the Nationalist High Command, where it was used by bomber captains and bomber pilots and submarine captains looking for targets. There were 29 oil tankers bringing oil to the Spanish Republic during the war that were sunk, damaged, or captured. And in one or two cases, we can actually tie that to information supplied by Texaco.
Well, tell us more about Reber. He had an interesting beginning.
He did. Born in Norway, went to sea as a sailor at the age of 15, sailed on a clipper ship that sailed, you know, the old sailing ship, sailed around Cape Horn.
Hey, I had a grandfather who did that.
No kidding. Are you of Norwegian descent also?
Yeah, I had a grandfather who actually, he lost his thumb helping pull down the sails during a storm. And he lived in Oakland for 17 years or something like that before a relative looked him up.
No
but
kidding.
Anyway, back to our story.
Yeah. I mean, I love Norway. I wish Reber had come from somewhere else, but that is, in fact, where he was from. Left at the age of 15, worked as a sailor, then worked his way up and became the captain of a tanker. And then when Texaco bought the tanker that he commanded, he realized in the oil business the big money was to be made on shore. So he came ashore, married his boss's secretary, rose up through the company, became CEO, and all his life had a great fondness for right-wing dictators. In later years, he was at one point oil advisor to the Shah of Iran. He helped fund an attempted military coup in Mexico, and actually, after the Spanish Civil War, he managed to keep it completely out of the news media that he was involved in helping Franco during the war with this illegal supply of oil on credit. American press showed no curiosity on the subject, whatever. After the war, he actually got himself in trouble because his penchant for hiring fascists meant that there were a couple of Germans who were working in Texaco, at Texaco, one in the New York office, one in the Berlin office. This was in 1940 when World War II had begun, but the United States was not yet in the war. And it turned out that the German in the United States in Texaco's office was using the company's communications channels to send intelligence information about U.S. aircraft industry and oil supplies and so on to his colleague in Berlin. British intelligence found out about this probably by eavesdropping on the transatlantic cable, leaked the story to the New York Herald Tribune, and Reber was forced to resign from Texaco.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting, you know, during the, actually just a few years before, some big executives actually were plotting a little coup to get Roosevelt out of office.
That's right.
You know,
that's,
I mean,
right.
So that's sort of a sign of the times. They tried to get General Smedley Butler to lead the revolt, but he turned them down. I think he turned them in.
He turned them down, and it's very much to his credit.
Well, it's interesting about... tell us about, you know, the Lincoln Brigade. Now, how many, there were a couple thousand? Well, volunteers?
There were more than 40,000 people from over 50 countries who went to Spain to fight for the Spanish Republic. The great majority of them were in what were called the International Brigades, which were the things basically organized by the world's communist parties. Of those fighters, 2,800 were American. Most, though not all of them, members or supporters of the Communist Party. They came from 46 of what was then 48 states. They came from every conceivable walk of life. The son of a former governor of Ohio, a vaudeville acrobat, longshoremen, teachers, college students. The first American to go into action in Spain, where he was fatally wounded, was a student at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania who ran away during his senior year, got to Spain actually before the other Americans, and he was put in the British battalion, fatally wounded in the battle for Madrid. And these 2,800 people, as I say, they came from all over the country. They included about 150 medical volunteers, doctors, nurses, ambulance drivers, who also volunteered in Spain. They were, I think, a brave group of people who, had, as did many leftists all over the world at that time, they had some illusions about the Soviet Union, but they were right that Spain was a crucial battleground. They saw this as the first battle of a larger world war that seemed to be coming. And in this, they were right. Where else, after all, were Americans in uniform being bombed by Nazi pilots 4 years before the U.S. officially entered World War II?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting about Torkel Reber. In the book, you talk about how, I think it's in 1940, he was at some gathering at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, and they were talking, a bunch of executives talking about the future of Europe under Nazi domination. And June of 1940, that was just a couple of months after the Germans invaded Norway.
That's
right. The fighting went on for a couple of months. So the fighting just about ended right around that time, and the Norwegian king was kind of escaped to England. And you really have to wonder, did Torkel Reber think anything about this or what?
I mean, not as far as we can tell. His enthusiasm for Hitler seemed to have overcome everything else.
He's kind of like a premature Quisling, I guess.
In a way.
It's amazing. This is Per Fagring, and the show is Political Perspectives, and I'm talking with Adam Hochschild, who is the author of Spain in Our Hearts, and he will be speaking tonight at Powell's downtown at 7:30, and get there early because it's not a huge room. And if anybody wants to call in with a question, the number is 503-231-8187. Let's talk about this sort of war within the war between the communists and the anarchists and the anti-Stalinist left. Part of that, of course, is because the Stalinists, they were the only ones who were supporting the Republican cause.
Well, I think
the democracy that kind of abdicated.
Yeah. I think this is a kind of situation that actually there have been versions of at other points in history. It's a question, can you fight a war for survival and have a revolution at the same time?
Mm-hmm.
That was what the dispute was in Spain. And there were similar versions of this at other points in time when the former slaves of Haiti fought for their freedom and won it in the 1790s. They then faced a war for survival their leader, Toussaint Louverture, forced them to go back to the old sugar plantations and start producing sugar for export again because it was desperately needed to buy arms abroad instead of breaking up these plantations and having their own farms, which was one of the things they thought they'd been fighting for and revolting against slavery. So this kind of tension appears at many points in history. And in Spain, I think the question was, on the one hand, the Communist Party and the mainstream parties of the Spanish Republic that were aligned with it felt that the only way to win the war against an army backed by Hitler and Mussolini would be to have everyone who was fighting reporting to a tightly controlled central command. The communists had an additional motive there because they wanted to control that central command. Nonetheless, I think they had a point in terms of what was necessary to win the war. The anarchists and their sympathizers, which included one or two other small left-wing parties, felt, no, you have to have a social revolution. That's what's going to get people excited and willing to fight, willing to risk their lives to defend the republic. This was the argument which was basically decided when that popular revolution was suppressed in May of 1937. And it's tragic that several hundred people had to lose their lives in the course of that. But the revolution was on the wane anyway, because I think some of the things that the anarchists wanted to do would have been impractical even under the best of circumstances, much less when fighting a desperate war for survival. They believed, for example, in eliminating the use of money as a means of exchange. Everything would take place by barter. There were villages where people burned piles of paper money. Well, there's something utopian and appealing about that idea, but when just over the mountains from you is an army backed by Hitler and Mussolini, it's maybe not the best time to be experimenting with utopian ideas.
Well, it's kind of interesting the way war has changed. Right now, here's the United States with this huge military machine, and it seems to be stymied, defeated by, well, they call it asymmetric warfare. Mm-hmm. And just looking at the dollars and cents of it is that it costs very little to mount a guerrilla operation, but it can cost the military power a lot of money and lives. And so I guess if in Spain, if they'd fought a guerrilla operation, well, then I don't know how would that have played out.
Well, there was a considerable amount of guerrilla fighting, because in the Spanish Civil War, in many places, like the outskirts of Madrid, for example, the front line looked like the front line in World War I, where everybody was dug into trenches right close to each other and you knew where the line was. In other places where the line between the Republic's forces and the Nationalist forces were, a mountain range or something like that, it was much more porous. And there were guerrilla raids by Republican forces across those mountains repeatedly. Actually, one of those raids is the subject matter for Ernest Hemingway's novel For Whom the Bell Tolls. And one thing which people are generally unaware of is that that's based on more than his imagination, because when he was a correspondent in Spain, he at one point, with special permission from the Army High Command, took part in a guerrilla raid where they walked across a mountain range at night, blew up a railway line, and walked back by dawn to get back to the Republic's side. And we have an account of that from the leader of the guerrilla band who spoke to a writer about this many years later. Hemingway himself never said anything about it, but there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that confirms that he actually did take part in this raid. And those aspects of For Whom the Bell Tolls have a very realistic ring to them.
Well, tell us more about Hemingway.
Well, Hemingway was a great writer and a thoroughly obnoxious human being. such a remarkable combination. His involvement with Spain, which I talk about a little bit in the book, had begun in the 1920s. Of course, the novel that first brought him to the world's attention, The Sun Also Rises, is based on a trip to Spain. He was really, up until the war began, he was really one of the more non-political American writers. He hadn't even bothered to vote in the 1936 presidential election. But when General Franco and the Nationalists rose up in revolt in the Spanish Republic, Hemingway took it personally. He felt it was an assault on a country and a culture that he deeply loved. He wanted to spend time there. He made four long trips, several months each, to Spain during the course of the war. The first three of them as a correspondent for the North American Newspaper Alliance, which was a consortium of some 50 newspapers in this country, and wrote a long series of dispatches, was an ardent backer of the Spanish Republic, so much so that he kept predicting victory even when the signs were were otherwise, was also involved in making this documentary film, The Spanish Earth, that we talked about, and brought it back with Martha Gellhorn to the White House and showed it to President Roosevelt, raised money for ambulances in Spain for the American Medical Unit, contributed money for an ambulance himself, was very generous in contributing funds to members of the Lincoln Brigade, the Americans who fought there, helped some of them out after the war, helped provide funds for them to come home. At the same time, you read the accounts of him in Spain, and he comes off as, people who describe meeting him, he always had to be the center of attention. He always had to be performing for a large crowd, making extravagant boasts of his prowess as a soldier, a lover, whatever. Not somebody that it would have been fun to spend a lot of time with, I think.
What was it? Martha Gellhorn said that something about the only time he stopped talking about himself?
The only time, she said, the Spanish Civil War was the only time in his life when something else seemed more important than he was.
Mm-hmm. Well, then Hemingway later went on to live in Cuba. And Herbert Matthews, who's also a reporter there, wrote articles all about Fidel Castro when he was still fighting Batista.
That's right. Herbert Matthews was the New York Times correspondent in Spain on the Spanish Republic side. Big buddy of Hemingway's. They used to travel around together. The Times also had a correspondent on the Nationalist side, a man named William P. Kearney. And both Kearney and Matthews became ardent supporters of the sides of the war that they were covering. Blind to its faults, touting its virtues. And the two men hated each other and sniped at each other in print a little bit. And you have to do this very indirectly in the long gray columns of the New York Times. But you can notice it if you read their reporting closely.
Talk about how this is sort of a precursor. Of course, Hitler and Mussolini were trying out their weapons, which they planned to use later on. And, of course, Hitler planned to use them against the Soviet Union. And I'm sure the Soviets were aware of this or afraid of this. And so, actually near the end of the Spanish Civil War, you had the Neville Chamberlain going to Munich.
That's right.
Giving away part of Czechoslovakia, although that's a whole different topic there about borders, but some other time. But it's, you kind of wonder what kind of, how did the world look from Stalin's point of view?
Well, I think Stalin, in 1936, when the Spanish Civil War began, Stalin, of course, was a world-class paranoid, but he was smart enough to know that he faced a real enemy in Hitler, because Hitler was talking about expanding to the east, and he didn't want Hitler to have another ally in Western Europe, in Spain. Stalin hoped that the British and French would step in and sell the Spanish Republic the arms that it needed. And he waited a couple of months before he sent any help. Then when it was clear that the British and French were not going to help out, and that if the Spanish Republic didn't get arms from somewhere, Madrid was going to be captured and the war would be over, at that point he started sending arms.
Well, I think Stalin hoped that the British and French would open up a second front later on in World War II.
Right, and it took them a while to do that.
Well, so I've read some accounts saying that that Chamberlain's goal, you know, in appeasing Hitler was not so much to appease Hitler, but sort of to point him east. You know, the idea of making sure that that Hitler didn't invade France or someplace, but get him to go after the Soviets.
Well, there were certainly many people in England who would have been happy to see Germany and the Soviet Union go to war, because they didn't have much use for either of them. But of course, what happened is that once Stalin saw the Britain and France making this kind of deal with Germany, he pursued a different strategy, which was a very cynical one, which is essentially to make a deal with Hitler, divide up Eastern Europe between the two of them. I think he thought it would stave off a German attack on Russia much longer than it actually did.
Mm-hmm. Well, you almost get to like a choice. I mean, like something I think myself, which is worse, you know, some Stalinist communist or a Nazi fascist? And I would have to say that the fascists are worse. I mean, you know, in the book you describe some of these sort of Stalinist people in Spain, and they come across as being pretty horrible people, but there's just something about the fascists that's like a different level of cruelty or something like that.
Well, I mean, if you look at things that happened in the Soviet Union and in places that it occupied during and after World War II, there was a lot of nastiness and cruelty there, too. Mm-hmm. I would not wish domination by either a communist or a fascist power on any country.
Well, that's true, but sometimes there's no choice. I mean, I just think, you know, in my life I've met some communists and I've met some fascists, and I don't know, something about the fascists is really creepy.
Well, that's true. But, you know, sometimes there are grim choices that one has to make. And I think many people who were living in the Spanish Republic or who supported it overseas were wise to the fact that the Soviet Union was by no means a paradise, but it was the only major power that was willing to supply arms for a price to Spain. And those arms were essential. You know, the Soviets had their own motives for doing it. You know, it wasn't out of altruism, but I'm glad they did. I think it meant that the war, you know, did not. If the war had ended much sooner, it would have allowed Franco to get installed in power sooner. It might have given Hitler even more confidence than he had that he could conquer the world.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of brave Americans died.
That's right. Of those 2,800 Americans, about 750 were killed, and most of the remainder were wounded, some of them seriously.
And the Spanish suffered about 35 years of a pretty horrible dictatorship.
They did. They suffered roughly 200,000 combat deaths during the war. More than 200,000 people lost to political assassination from both sides during the war and its aftermath, the great majority of them killed by the nationalists. And the country was just economically devastated. And then, as you say, had the 36 years of dictatorship under General Franco.
Now Spain is a democracy, and it's interesting. Barcelona seems to be, once again, the center of some kind of a social revolution, the Catalonian Revolution, secession movement.
Secession movement, but I think that's a different it's a different thing. Mm-hmm. And the important thing is that Spain is a democracy. That's what these Americans who fought in that war were fighting for. And I think they'd be pleased that that was the long-term result.
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking to Adam Hochschild, the author of Spain in Our Hearts, all about the Spanish Civil War, which all of us need to know more about. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Per.
And for people who want to hear more, go down to Powell's tonight at 7:30, and he will be speaking there. Powell's at 10th and Burnside.
And I'll also be showing some pictures there, too.
Oh, wow. Thank you very much. Okay. Well, this is KBOO, your radio station. Stay tuned.
Cries from the cities, shouts from the hills, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. The fire in the hearts that is warming us still, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. No passerán, no passerán, so sang the Abe Lincoln Brigade. Across the years and the oceans, we still sing the song of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland, and it is now just 9 o'clock. Excuse me, it's 10 o'clock. It's 9:59. Coming up on the Boo at 10:15, Flashpoints reports on Mexican environmentalist Gustavo Castro, who was wounded after the murder of Honduran indigenous leader Berta Cáceres. He is free and back in Mexico. And we hear from the author of Unsettled, Cambodian Refugees in the New York City Hyperghetto. And at 11, it's the KBOO Bike Show, bringing you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Stay tuned for Air Cascadia, with headlines, interviews, and commentary by Chris Andre.
Oh, my house of Israel, why will you die?
Why will you die?
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Amish Project, a play running from April 8th through April